You're always smiling. Well, we're so dour, it's annoying how cheerful you are. It's annoying how cheerful you are. It's annoying how full of cheer you are.
Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable. Welcome to our panel discussion. Welcome to Wednesday. Welcome to 9:13 in the morning. It's going pretty good so far, isn't it? I'll tell you, we're sitting here in the room, the studio around the rounded table, and we're having a conversation. And we have much to discuss, but I will say that our main focus is on this whale video. If you've not seen this yet, It is simply stunning. This is a whale breaching and capsizing a fishing boat off the shore of New Hampshire, and I don't know if you've ever been on a whale watch. If you've ever been lucky enough to be on a whale watch, whether it be north, south, east, or west, they're just magical. If you know, you see whales. And the one time I went, Kelly and I went on one, they were just popping out all over the place. And the narrator said, well, if you look to your left, if you look to your right, in fact, if you look anywhere, you're going to see a whale. And this is one of the best sightings we've ever had. Well, but I never thought they were going to jump into the boat. I never had that thought. So the video is just of this whale coming out of the water, and you see it emerge, and you're like, oh, all right, this is good. This is going to be a little nudge. And the next thing, the whale just lands on the back of the boat, and the boat goes up, and then
people,
of course,
go flying,
capsizes, and the people go flying. Now, the end of the story is good in the sense that everybody's fine.
Yes.
Nobody was hurt.
Except for the boat.
The boat. And then fill out that insurance form, right?
Yeah.
And then these kids were on another boat, and one's taking the video, and the other kid's like, how do I get the hell out of here before the whale comes after our boat?
Yes.
And I think it's video like this that saves us from ourselves.
All I can say is I'm going to reflect very carefully on the size of boats I'm going to use for anything now.
The boat just goes up and just like spins around.
Like
it's like a little toy.
It was like a little dreidel move.
Yeah. It's but I mean, that is the ultimate whale sighting, and good for them. But two overboard. But the Coast Guard said they were uninjured and promptly rescued. So that is the good news of the story. And of course, they will always have a hell of a fish story.
And
to
you
tell
know
us.
What? They might get interviews on TV at some
point. Oh, I bet they will. I would welcome them. I'd dispatch all of you right now if I could have the two of them in here. And the whale? Hell, let's go. Good morning, all. We welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org. If you'd like to be with us and share in your thoughts as to what's going on in the world today, let me introduce the group, and we'll get started. We won't talk any more about whales, but it'll be tempting. Jennifer Burns is here, UAlbany lecturer in Africana Studies. Good morning, Jennifer. How are you?
Good morning. I'm happy to be here, like always.
Wonderful to have you with us. We also welcome Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics, Vera Akarias-Kelly. Good morning, Vera. How are you?
Good morning, everyone. I'm equally good.
Very nice to have you with us. Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin. Good morning, Bob.
Hey, Joe. You know, today is National Tequila Day. Not just for breakfast anymore. You know, every once in a while, they just get it right.
Yeah, not just for breakfast anymore. And I we should celebrate that too.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right.
I was going to say, hold your tequila jokes.
And Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick. Good morning, Judy. How are you?
I am fine. I think I'm the only one in the room who's not worried about the start of the fall semester.
Oh, yeah.
That might be true.
We have three
yes,
professors.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, a lot of professors in the room, sure. It feels kind of good. I'm actually not teaching this fall either, and I'm like, oh, okay, this is good. I can worry about whale videos. All right, let's get to what's going on this morning, and we'll start right in. I think we've been talking about, obviously, the Harris campaign and the current race, but I would like to start this morning by something that happened shortly after we left the program yesterday, and that is the resignation of the Secret Service director. Kimberly Cheadle faced scrutiny after the attempted assassination of former President Donald Trump at a rally. On Monday, there was a congressional hearing, and in a great show of bipartisanship, both Republican and Democratic members of the committee looked at her and said, "What? Well, what are you talking about?" And so eventually, there was a lot of pressure, obviously, on her to resign. The final report from the committee said that she should resign. And yesterday, indeed, she decided that she would actually resign. So that brings us to what happened, and still a lot of questions about the assassination attempt itself. And Kimberly Cheadle resigned. "In light of recent events, it is with a heavy heart that I have made the difficult decision to step down as your director," Cheadle wrote in a letter to staff, saying she took full responsibility for the failure. "The incident does not define us," Cheadle told the staff. "I do not want my calls for resignation to be a distraction from the great work each and every one of you do towards our vital mission." The attack, in which a gunman opened fire with an AR-style rifle from an unsecured roof at a Trump presidential campaign rally July 13th, was the first against a U.S. leader on the elite protective agency's watch in more than 40 years. Cheadle, a veteran Secret Service agent, had called the security failure unacceptable and acknowledged that the buck stops with me. Took her a little while to figure that out or to come to that immediate conclusion. However, just everything, more and more information started to mount that was negative toward the agency. And Bob, I guess the easiest way to say this is that, I mean, obviously it's a significant failure if the person that you are set to, your entire job is to protect that person, and that person gets struck by a bullet, that would definitely be a failure.
It was definitely a failure. And her presentation was, talking to Judy about professors at the table. If my first year gave a presentation like that, I would be pulling them aside saying, "You obviously did not prepare for this class, so go back and do it again." I'm glad I'm going first, because there's nothing good to say about what happened yesterday. I mean, I was embarrassed. I was embarrassed for her. I was embarrassed for the organization. I don't know how she wasn't prepared. I mean, anybody with a lick of common sense could have came up with the top 10 questions that were going to be asked. And she did something, you know, that we don't see much. She basically created a bipartisan answer to a problem, and the problem was her. I was shocked at the lack of quality. I was shocked at the lack of answers. I think it was really embarrassing. Mm-hmm. What's really clear, though, to me, Joe, is that there is, while the end result was a catastrophic failure, there are multiple failure points in what occurred at that event that's going to require a total review and rewrite of protocols, because the system didn't work in multiple different ways. So it wasn't just one element of failure. Mm-hmm. It was multiple. Mm-hmm. And she should have gone. She absolutely should have gone.
Well, let me just ask you a quick question, then I want to go to Vera. But sure. One of the arguments and I never found it to be a strong argument, but one of the arguments was, as we're investigating this and as we're trying to figure out what the systemic problems are, that it is helpful to then have the person who is responsible for those failures to at least be in the room. But I mean, my problem with that is, okay, but you still have like tomorrow's event, right? Mm-hmm. So, and if the failures are the failures, then will those failures continue? But how do you move on a dime in an agency like this when there's so much at stake?
So what they'll do is that they'll be hyper attentive, almost to the point of going too far the other way, being restrictive. They came out with a request yesterday that I read about, asking for just interior events, no outside events, which are harder to guide, mm-hmm. to plan for, and so they're already putting changes in place. I would imagine for any of the events for either Harris or Trump, going forward, if you're planning to attend, plan to go even earlier than you did before, because it's going to take a lot longer to get in. So mm-hmm. there will be a lot of heightened security. The issue, though, you know, I think what bothers me is I don't disagree with what you said about, you know, you want the person in the room to help make the changes, but there was nothing in her presentation that pointed me to her bringing any value added. And I'll stop and turn it over to the other panelists.
Yeah.
So I was thinking, you know, I only listened to parts of the hearing because it was so ridiculous. I just couldn't take it anymore. She was obfuscating. She was non-transparent. She had no answers. It was quite shocking, actually, for somebody who was in a leadership position. So I wonder. So there are two trains of thoughts that I have on this. Either she got really poor advice on how to deal with a congressional hearing, and she was told, don't disclose anything, just say it's under investigation, you know, some lawyerly sort of tactic. Or there's something that's hidden that she didn't want to open some doors, and there are some really serious fundamental problems within the Secret Service that she didn't want to address at all. And we know that the Secret Service has had a history during the Obama era already. They had Secret Service agents flying into Colombia and having sexual relations with prostitutes and other women. And they were the front people, the front team, and they didn't secure Obama's arrival. They had a fun party and got totally drunk. Mm-hmm. So there might be some issues within the Secret Service that she was trying not to disclose, and this sort of lawyering in front of Capitol Hill. It was shocking.
Would that have made a difference if it was a closed hearing as opposed to an open hearing?
Yeah, I mean, and you know, Vera, you're right. I would note, though, that nothing looks like conspiracy quite like incompetence.
Print the bumper stickers.
If there was something that was getting into anything that would affect security, she could have simply said, "This is something that we really need to talk to you about, but I would ask that we go into, you know, a classified hearing."
Right. Which she didn't even do.
Yeah. So I mean, there is the opportunity to say it, but she didn't even give the agency that option.
Yeah.
Judy.
There was some reporting that she had planned to resign, but not until after the Democratic National Convention. But yesterday's hearing or the day before hearing made that impossible. This information vacuum only exacerbates the conspiracy theories out there, and they are rampant about this mm-hmm. shooting. Coming forth with real information would have done at least something to tamp down those incredibly destructive conspiracy theories.
I mean, if you have nothing to say that's meaningful, then quit before you have to say it, right?
Right. She had been subpoenaed, and then the FBI directors before the Oversight Committee, I think, today. So maybe we'll get clearer information from him. Again, this seems like some basic information that certainly should have been conveyed to the public in that hearing and wasn't.
And also to dump everything on the local police. And, you know, come on. That was shocking in the beginning as a strategy. And then to sort of mislead about the slope of the roof. I mean, she didn't even have basic information that we now know from reporters in the field.
They're still overseeing the entire operation. And even if the local police...
Yes.
Or local law enforcement isn't doing what they're supposed to be doing, which I'm not saying
they weren't, right?
But were they ever directed properly? And that's the other right. question. Jennifer, I want to hear from you, but I want to take a quick break and then give you your full time instead of cutting you off in the middle. We'll take a break. When we return, we'll continue with our conversation. We have a lot of letters on this. We welcome yours. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. ORG will be, it's tequila day. We'll be back with our terrific group, Bob Griffin, Vera Carias Kelly, Jennifer Burns, and Judy Patrick. Again, we welcome your letters, panel@WAMC.org, and we'll continue after this break and news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday morning.
Yes.
Wednesday morning, the 24th. time has been elusive lately, hasn't it? We welcome your letters. We're talking about the head of the Secret Service finally resigning. I say finally because there had been calls ever since the assassination attempt. For her to resign, and she announced that resignation yesterday. The only one of two significant resignations in the news yesterday, Bob Menendez being the other, but we'll talk about that later. Jennifer Burns.
Okay, so the first thing, as I was reading through many articles about this, that I noticed is the consistent mentioning of being underfunded and understaffed in the Secret Service. And I don't know a lot about the allocation of money and how that is determined and what training goes into preparing people for the Secret Service. So I thought that was really interesting. And then also the pushback one of the criticisms of Cheadle was that she was hiring more women or that she had a focus on hiring more women, and it was sort of just like dropped there, and I didn't quite know what to make of it. Like, if that it was a criticism clearly of her, and like another way to say that she was single-minded and really kind of just looking in sort of the anti-DEI attacks that are going on right now. And then the other thing, which I had brought up before we went on the air, was that I found it really interesting that many of the women in leadership positions that are now going before the House committees there seems to be a pattern where they're either advised, and it's a systemic problem, where they're advised to perform this way, or they're given misguided direction on how to respond, or they're not prepared. Almost like a bit of a weird sexist training that this should be the way to address this questioning at that sort of level. And I don't know where to go with that yet.
So
but
why
there
would
just
you
seems
do
to be
then,
a sense
though?
Across the board. What do you mean?
Meaning if you're trained that way and it still doesn't seem to be the right thing to do, why would you do it?
I don't know. I think that when you're starting to see more and more women in some of these upper level positions, and some of the mentors or advisees may have some microaggressions that they're not familiar with, it's not as if they're all in the same room getting advice from the same people. It could be the some of the preparation of the people who are advising them or giving them advice.
And this
that's
is,
off.
And this is not in any way getting her off the hook.
Absolutely not. I mean, it could also be women who are advising her to just be quiet, you know, say little as you can as a protection mechanism. But it could also be men who are saying, you know, your lawyers or others will handle this. And this is the proper way to seem strong and stoic and protect yourself. So you don't really know, but it just seems like a common pattern for many of these women.
So the pattern you're referring to were some of the college
university
presidents
who were brought before the House Committee. Yeah,
and like it's sort of some patterns
similar,
like that too.
Yeah, like speaking points. Yeah. And in this case with Cheadle, not speaking points, but where they are, I don't want to say they're projecting or deflecting, but they just seem misleading and it makes them look like they're being led rather than they're leading in their positions. And that someone else, they're speaking the words of someone else rather than their own thoughts and training.
They seem inauthentic. Right?
Bob?
Yeah, the preparation, I mean, unless it's changed since I was there, I mean, there's a team that will prepare you. Mm-hmm. And we would go through something that we would call a murder board where there would be people playing the roles of the individuals on Congress who would grill you to try to stress test your answers. So the idea that you were prepared differently, I don't think so. I don't think that's the case. Now, what I don't know or what constraints were put on her to say, you know, listen, you're going to take a bullet for us anyway. So these are things we don't want you to say. And that was always, I always found that really difficult because the way I would have answered a question versus the way I was instructed to in order to follow the policy line of the administration were sometimes two very different things.
But regardless, you would think you would have some answer for why did you let him walk around with a scope?
Well, that and the timeline. I mean, again, I think we said on break, she could have just read one of the articles from one of the major newspapers and given more information than she did there. The excuse about not having enough resources, I'm sorry, that's garbage, okay? Every agency is always complaining about lack of resources. There's plenty of money in DHS to put resources into its core mission, and including especially the Secret Service. So I thought that was disingenuous. The training they get is exceptional. I mean, it is a well-trained organization.
So I have a question, though, for you on the budget issue, because I recall seeing some data that the Secret Service gets half the annual amount of New York City's police department.
Okay.
And they have a lot more people to protect now because the families are enlarging and we have, you know, I mean, the entire Trump clan gets protection. The Obamas, prior presidents, the children, the Bidens. So it seems like a lot of people in this more violent-prone environment need protection, get protection, including federal judges. And so maybe that needs to be revisited in terms of what their key mission is in terms of protection and if there's another agency they can do other types of protections or if they need a bigger budget.
So I'm sorry,
she was asked if she had resources for the issue, and she said no. And she was asked if the department was under stress and didn't have the resources they needed because of the NATO summit that had just happened and had used a lot of time. And she said no. She was asked if she needed congressional representatives asked her if said to her if you needed more money, you could have come to us and asked for it. And she said I didn't need more money.
And just to clarify, the Secret Service doesn't protect the judges. Okay.
Oh, okay.
So that's the U.S. Marshals.
Oh, U.S.
Okay.
Marshals.
So,
okay.
So
thank
one
you
of the
that.
Things that this gets into into the weird bureaucracy, but like the court system has its own security details. Okay. The Department of Defense has its own security details. The Secret Service has yes, a large portfolio, but there are other people doing other things. And Congress has its own security. And right. I understand the reason is that Congress doesn't want to be beholden on the executive branch for their security. Mm-hmm. So you see the balance of power come to everything, including security. But the issue of resources, if the Secret Service doesn't have enough resources, the first place they go is the secretary, and the secretary will move money. I mean, I ran the research and development arm of the department. We were one of the first places that they would go to raid if one of the primary mission spaces didn't have, you know, if the Coast Guard didn't have something or the Secret Service didn't have something. I mean, there is huge opportunity to move money. So I agree with you. I don't think it's a resource issue. It was a failure of imagination. It was a failure of protocol. It was a failure of thinking broadly enough about what the threat vectors are.
So I'm so glad you're on to explain all this to us. So if it's not money and if it's not training, as you say, I would say then it must be communication or leadership style. And, you know, when I look at communication, I mean things like where agencies don't really communicate well, like where the sheriff's office did not really meet extensively or speak with responsible agents, or agents didn't reach out enough, or there's something going on where the flow of information was disrupted. And that goes back to leadership style. You know, if you're not welcoming the flow of information in the broadest way, then new leadership has to come. I mean, we saw her performance was pathetic, obviously, in this hearing, but in general, then I would say the blame is to be placed on some kind of obstruction within the bureaucracy and the ability to communicate not just hierarchically up, but across agencies or across different units.
It could be something as simple as complacency too. It could be. I mean, we're talking about human beings. Yeah. It could be that, that they were rushing. Mm-hmm. They were rushing this event with their eyes towards what was going on with Milwaukee just a few days later. I mean, sometimes we assume that there is some sort of grand conspiracy behind these issues, and sometimes it's just human nature, and that's really is what has got to get teased out, and then part of what the agencies are going to have to do is, how do you overcome that complacency? Mm-hmm. How do you overcome the blind spots in your systems and your red teaming in order to make sure that you have multiple layers that can pick up when you're not doing what you need to do before even the shooter can even get in a position to do what they want to do?
There is a great amount of sexism with this thing, though. Saw a lot of criticism online on social media about the female Secret Service agents that had surrounded Trump and had in the huddle to get him off the stage, making fun of their appearance, making fun of how they handled their guns. You're hearing criticism about the agency's efforts to bring more women into the Secret Service agency. All unfounded, but this is, ginned up this debate in a way that will transcend and reach into the, the political or the presidential race. Mm-hmm.
So I want to take a break and then I want to come back. I want to get to letters too. Also, the other news from yesterday is hours after the head of the Secret Service resigns, it is announced that, hey, it's probably not a good idea for President Trump or any candidate to have events outdoors. I want to talk about how that figures into all of this as well. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
7 minutes, hybrid lungs. Final breath, the end is come. And it's one.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. And we welcome you. We are talking about the Secret Service. We're talking about the resignation of the Secret Service director. And we welcome you to this discussion, panel at WAMC.org. Mike writes, the idea that more information will help quash conspiracy theories. No. 9/11, January 6th, dot, dot, dot. Then
it's true, Joe, but think about the weird part about this, though, is that you have conspiracy theories on both sides. I mean, mm-hmm. so you got QAnon and BlueAnon conspiracy theories on this one. And for us in the middle, more information does help. I mean, if you're a crazy conspiracy theory, nothing's going to conspirator, nothing's going to help. But for a lot of us, just having competent answers to basic questions mm-hmm. that we knew were going to get answers would have done wonders for mm-hmm. my sort of state of understanding.
Especially in the context where we know the FBI director has warned for a long time that we have an uptick in political mm-hmm. violence in this country. Yeah. And to think that the Secret Service may have been complacent, or where agents may have thought, well, nothing has happened in 40 years, why should it this time? And that disconnect, we want to have answers to that, because I think it's very important for us to understand what went wrong to address it, right? You don't know what's wrong, you can't address it, you can't make it better.
Paul writes and says, don't rush to judgment. The head of the Secret Service did... Let's try that again. Don't rush to judgment. The head of the Secret Service did the right thing by resigning. However, like the immigration issues along our border, they don't have the resources to do what they are mandated to do. Think of all the judges and politicians and other people who have been threatened by the MAGA crazies. The Secret Service has been very, very busy because of this, and they are doing it with reduced resources. So let's be a little more balanced and fair about this. You addressed this just a moment ago, Bob.
Yeah. The resources, I believe that the resources are there. I also agree that the resignation was required, and I think whoever's at the top of an organization that has this type of catastrophic failure in a core should be held accountable.
We got a letter that says, refrain from using Joe, Uncle Joe. President Biden is our president. Please show respect.
Did we use
I don't remember using that, but no. I don't... In fact, we've been talking about Trump, so I don't know.
So I don't know what that reference is.
I know we got this yesterday about Kamala and Harris, and we get it always about if we refer to President Trump as opposed to former President Trump. But
okay,
we understand. Okay.
National Tequila Day, Joe. Somebody's celebrating.
Yeah. All right, let's go to, I want to go to the issue. I don't know, I didn't give a chance for you all to discuss this, but so then the natural thing is, what went wrong? Well, we had it outside, so let's do everything inside, and that's a much more contained environment, which obviously makes sense.
Right. Yeah, it's easier. It's easier to control the perimeter. It's easier to control the envelope. You can go in and scan. The line of sights are easier to control. It was something we talked about last week. And honestly, I think that was the right call. Yep.
So when people are saying that's more expensive, why is it more? In what ways is it more expensive?
You got to rent the facility while a field's a lot cheaper. That in itself
write that
is
from the start.
Right. Yeah. I mean, just the facility costs and things like that.
And also we're late in the game now, there are all kinds of sports events in arenas, and now you have to compete as a political speaker. And we know Trump doesn't really like that kind of environment, because he doesn't like it when there are any open seats, and he likes to just have crowds look like they're large. So Trump himself has been opposed. Bless you. Trump himself has been opposed to that kind of a choice. For a number of reasons, but also because he feels re-energized by crowds. And arenas, if he gets them,
and they don't fill up,
is really going to make him upset.
Right, where you can make that look how you want to.
Yeah, now he might have to hire crowds.
Amazing things.
You know, there's been some reporting, although that former President Donald Trump has this fear of being assassinated. And that shortly after this near-death experience, he decided he didn't want to do outdoor rallies anymore. You expect this to cross into the political debate where I've already seen a little bit of this, where you have Republicans saying Donald Trump asked for more coverage and wasn't getting it. And blame being put on the Biden administration for leaving former President Donald Trump out, you know, out in the cold and susceptible to this kind of attack.
But my understanding of that, while the that fact may be true, where there was a request made and the request was denied, but also because that a lot of this was an enormous amount of events that were happening, also that he announced his candidacy, you know, 5 minutes after January 6th. So that goes on a lot longer, whereas that would not have been the case in a, not that there is such a thing anymore, a quote-unquote typical political season.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing typical, but the idea of, you know, there are a couple of elements that have been raised already on the panel. I think we should pull together. One, the anti-DEI, anti-quote woke position that the Republican Party has taken. You see this in this really, these really scurrilous attack on female agents, that somehow this was part of a conspiracy that women are less women agents are less competent than male agents, or the fact that that Secret Service is hiring female officers is a slight to the burly men from the special forces that could have been protecting Trump.
I like how your voice changes.
Burly men.
But I've seen that. I've actually been seeing this on places like YouTube, where they put clown music to agents who are throwing, literally putting their bodies between a potential shooter and the president, and the former president. And then you have the issue that Judy just raised about this idea that somehow that Biden, you know, the Biden administration conspired to do this. This is part of this whole narrative that has gone on since prior to January 6th of, you know, a couple years ago, somehow he's, you know, somehow there's a grand conspiracy to take down Donald Trump, and it plays into his messianic garbage that he has sold his cult.
Well, it also builds for his base more support for him to be dictator-like, that he's got to protect himself, so then he needs to appoint or hire, right, other people, and the government should foot this, and then later he would, if he became president, would be able to do it through his administration for himself, too, right? And that's very scary.
And they need to get something to get enthused about, because they have an absolute, you know, jackrabbit of a vice presidential candidate. They have no policy position, and they thought they were going to be running against, you know, President Joe Biden, and they're not. And, you know, they've got a—
They're panicking.
Yeah. I mean, so all of this stuff, they're throwing a lot against the wall right now.
They're going to see what sticks, right? And the whole idea that
I hope Jackrabbit of a presidential vice presidential candidate.
I know, that's right.
I hope that sticks.
I know. That guy is just like this guy. I call him the junior Trump, because he's a tech dog just like former President Trump, right?
He's nowhere as smart. He's nowhere as eloquent either.
Yeah, I feel like he's the middle ground between Trump and Mike Pence, or that's what he's trying.
He's trying to
play that role, but he will go where Mike Pence wouldn't, right?
Yes, so he's kind of— I mean, he's just a chameleon in a worse way than Pence. Mm-hmm. I think you're right. You know, he's just, you know, whenever it's required, he'll be messianic or, you know, religious.
But he plays the, like, golly gee.
And then he's the supposed hillbilly who then suddenly is the urban man from Cincinnati and the Yale educated. I mean, he's
just what we should expect from a Yale graduate. Yeah.
sad, isn't
that? Oh, my goodness. All right. Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We'll move on to other topics. There certainly are many to discuss, and we will do so in due course. First, we're going to take a news break, but we do welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we would love to hear from you, as always, WAMC.org. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning for this Wednesday, the 24th of July. Very nice to have you with us and a great pleasure. We welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We have Judy Patrick, Vera Carius Kelly, Bob Griffin, and Jennifer Burns with us to discuss the news of the day. And, of course, we welcome you. Let me go to another topic. We have been talking about the Secret Service, but I would like to change the topic and move on to some other stuff this morning. Of course, we are still, I think many of us, still processing the humongous news that is the President of the United States, Joseph R. Biden, leaving the race and turning his support to Kamala Harris. Now, we see that Harris is having rallies that are huge. The money is coming in at a rate that I don't think anyone expected. And then now, with all of this, is the Trump campaign trying to calibrate and figure out how exactly to run against this. And you also have there's so much to talk about. One is that President Biden will be speaking to the nation tonight at 8 o'clock, which you can hear here on WAMC. So that's one. Two, one of the first national surveys conducted since the switch showed a tight race with Harris at 44 and Trump at 42, according to a Reuters Ipsos poll. The same survey put Trump at 43 and Biden at 41% before the latter bowed out. That is a, what do they call it, Judy, a flash poll? Is that what, like a very quick turnaround poll? But there is this flood of cash that is pouring into the Harris campaign and allied groups. The support, we knew it was coming, but the support of the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and the House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, both saying that they were supporting her as well. And the news yesterday that ultimately there were enough committed delegates that she could capture the nomination as of this moment. So all things going the way of the vice president and the Kamala Harris campaign, what could possibly go wrong? Judy.
Well, I'm not saying that this might go wrong, but the president, is Joe Biden, is giving an address tonight at 8 o'clock. I'm anxious to see what he will say about what he's going to do with the rest of his term and the amount of support he intends to give his vice president as she campaigns to replace him. But the one thing that is going wrong right now are the Republicans are coming out and just viciously attacking Kamala Harris. I think she has the fortitude to withstand it. She's seen it before. She can stand up to it. And I think there is an army of people who will rise up and support her as well. My advice to people, we're all on social media. If you see hateful, sexist, racist information out there, don't just, pass it by. Stand up to it and say this is wrong. This is there's a lot of bad information out there. If you're not sure that something is true, go to Snopes.com. Check it out. They're a very good fact finder. And find out whether or not that racist meme is actually true, whether that video is, artificially generated. Be a responsible citizen. We all need to do that. And don't spread false information. That's just my advice going forward.
Vera?
Well, I actually think that the enthusiasm is so high at the moment that, you know, I saw some dear friends last night for dinner, and they were like, you know, oh, we donated the first day, and then we donated again the next day. And then, you know, so they're like really happy to support her, right? And so we have to be prepared that, you know, we are on this incredible upswing of enthusiasm because we actually have somebody dynamic, enjoyable, articulate, thoughtful on stage now, right? So we're all excited to see Kamala Harris. But then after the convention, the battle continues. And a lot of people have stepped up to volunteer, and we need many, many, many people to volunteer and reach out to voters that are unsure. And so that's the long game. But Democrats tend to be pretty good at that, actually, in terms of outreach. So I think we have to be prepared that we're on the upswing, but it'll like flatten out a little bit at some point. So don't be disappointed when that happens. We just have to work harder to get her more support.
I would say that I agree with you, although I don't think it's a short honeymoon. I mean, this is not a person who announced and received the nomination and has 2 years to campaign. Yes. Right. So the shorter amount of time also means some people will be and stay engaged. Right. The other thing is things are going to sort of calm down right now. I think some people may be throwing some money or not, but it's summer and they're doing other things, but they may be excited. And so if they're not giving money or necessarily tapping in right yet, it will come in September when everybody starts to go back to school and all of those things take place. And then we're only looking at 2 months, right? A little less than that before the election. And I think the other thing is there are many trusted allies that Kamala Harris has. And they're really knowledgeable in politics and especially at the grassroots level. And so a name that hasn't come up a lot but I've been wondering about is Stacey Abrams and how she's trying to galvanize because she'd already done so many years of work and building trust. And you know, in other areas too where Kamala Harris has local churches, she's got connections through the Divine Nine. She has, I think, will have so many foot soldiers that it's not just knocking on doors. It's also, even if you can't do all of this, make sure you're registered and you go vote on this day. And I think that's something that we can't really record fully yet.
I'm glad you brought up Stacey Abrams because I've been meaning to say this and wanting to say this, but there's been so much to talk about. But let us not forget that essentially it was between Stacey Abrams and Kamala Harris in 2020 as to who then candidate Biden was going to choose for the nomination, so that makes it really interesting, doesn't it, as to what that role is and what she's been able to accomplish on her own without that position over the last 3.5 years.
And this is not just a black thing. I'm not just Stacey Abrams has a multiracial, multi-ethnic group of people that have been working for her and growing, especially among the young or the youth, I should say. I don't want it to seem like that it's just this one group that's doing it. There's more unity there that's cross-racial and cross-ethnic.
What I hope Biden does tonight, though, is that I hope he talks to us about what it means to be the president and that sometimes you need to do what's right for the country, not what's right for you personally. And honestly, I hope Biden calls on Trump to resign, to do the similar, that you're too old. the beauty of where we are today versus where we are last week. I mean, I'll be honest, we were in the dumps last week. We were Worried. Really despondent. Yeah. And the
no
level,
tequila.
And the, yes, the level, of, I felt like the boat, Joe. I mean, it was.
Am I the whale or am I the boat?
That was definitely the boat last week. But, you know, think about it. What Biden did is that in the selfless act that he made, and it had to have been heart-wrenching, he put country first, okay? And he stepped aside in order to allow somebody to run who's running for president, not because she's seeking a pardon for herself, She doesn't own the Israeli Hamas conflict. She has the ability to turn this election into a sprint, which I think really plays to her power. Yep. Mm-hmm. And the fact that she's running against what will be an octogenarian and a 39-year-old who pretends he's an octogenarian is plays to her strength and the enthusiasm. I think it can carry through to November.
It's kind of infectious, isn't it?
Oh, it is.
The way we feel right now. And I think yesterday on stage, I don't know if anybody watched her give the talk in Milwaukee, but I have to say the ease with which she thanked anybody in the state who was in the highest office to like mayoral office, and she had worked with people, she was personally connected, so she's incredibly well networked, as you said, Jennifer, right? So I think she has the grassroots in place in many locations, and we can't underestimate the power of that.
And she's going to force something that Biden, that President Joe R. Biden, couldn't force, and that's Trump to be Trump. Okay, and I think that the Harris candidacy forces him to have to be himself, and I want anyone out there who's listening to start to think about and listen to what he's saying, how he approaches women, how he approaches the minorities, marginalized communities. Mm-hmm. I mean, the coalition that is going to be required to win really needs to listen to what Donald Trump is and is about. And with the Biden candidacy, it could have just been about him and his age. Mm-hmm. And now Trump is going to have to be about Trump. And people are not going to like what they see.
Yeah, you can already sense a hesitancy on his part to debate her. I mean, originally he was scheduled to debate Joe Biden, President Joe Biden, in September on ABC. Now you're hearing that he doesn't want to do that. He'd like to have a debate maybe on Fox, and maybe we'll change those ground rules that allowed the mics to be muted when it wasn't your turn to talk. I think he or the people around him are afraid of having him on the same stage with her. I think his ego will get the better of him, and eventually he will do it, and maybe that debate performance will be his undoing, just like Joe Biden's debate performance was his undoing.
Well, that is if we get, right? That is if we actually get the debate. I mean, if there's a lot of pushing around.
I doubt he's going to go for it, actually.
But if we don't, that is something that we should all take to the ballot box. And the mighty Donald Trump is afraid. Let's call it the way it is, okay? He is afraid to debate
a woman.
Vice President Harris. A woman.
Well, and a lot of the language and the tools that he's relied on in the past would be really devastating to him if they came out when he was debating Kamala Harris. Because, as we were saying during the break, J.D. Vance's wife is facing a lot of attacks, racial attacks, ethnic attacks, you know. And if you kind of are using some of that in the anti-DEI and the anti-woke stuff, that you've put it out in the atmosphere in a way that you've ignited people also to do it to your VP's wife, and it makes it really difficult for you then to say, don't do it to her, but it's okay for us to do it to her.
Yeah, I mean, as an Indian American woman, right, and Kamala Harris, Vice President Kamala Harris, is also Indian American, Asian American, and African American or Jamaican American. Mm-hmm. So when you think about that, one attack is the same as the other, right? Yep. And so if the base, the MAGA base, does that, they have made apparently some in the past few months. They've made some inroads within minority communities. Well, that's going to end real quick.
Mm.
At least I would definitely say among women. I mean, this is so appalling to women. Some of this language that is being used, and it's just devastating and hurtful, and it sort of goes back and puts women into the pre-suffragettes movement.
It also brings all Americans, you know, into a conversation about the rising anti-Asian attacks that usually get swept under the rug so frequently, because it's always a binary between black and white. So I think it's going to be really difficult for some of the people on former President Trump and J.D. Vance's staff to navigate this.
Because, I mean, it is former President Trump who started this with the, you know, the COVID blame on Asians, and then he spread these vicious rumors. And so the way it's been carried out among some of the white nationalist, racist crowd, it's been really horrific for Asian Americans in many, many ways, in urban environments, but also in smaller towns. I have friends who feared, in months past, to even walk the streets sometimes when certain people were out. And I mean, it was shocking to see that so openly supported by former President Trump.
There's also a line of attack that I find I'm finding interesting. I like the panel to discuss is the attack on Harris for not having children. but to me, it's like this is an opportunity to reset the discussion of this election back to issues like reproductive freedoms, the idea of availability of contraceptive, of 2025, of fundamental rights that we have assumed as a country that have been stripped away by the far right. And I don't think Biden could have done that. This truly, in my mind, is a historic pivot during an election in the best possible way. Again, I love the fact that we're talking about a sprint. And I can tell you right now, Harris can outrun Trump any day of the week.
And her language is so much more modern and updated. I mean, President Biden has sort of this reluctance to use certain words related to women's reproductive rights, and he couldn't really articulate that very well. She's an expert in that way.
I just would like to point out that I am a man, and and yet still became outraged by J.D. Vance saying that if you were a childless couple, which my wife and I are, a child-free couple, if you were a child-free couple, he used childless, but okay, that you did not have as much skin in the game and that you were not a productive member of society because you were not invested in the future.
Oh.
I think that's really interesting that you not only, because please do not misinterpret what I'm saying, that is still incredibly insulting to women, but that's also just incredibly insulting to couples who do not have children.
Well, you know, and the other part about this is that it is so blatantly sexist that we sometimes skip it because nobody's saying that about men who are running in government who don't have children. They don't say, why aren't they? Why don't they have these children that they're rearing so that they can talk about?
But this is a couple. You know, you're a couple, and you're not having children. Then you should pay more because you're not invested in the future. You do not have a say in what's happening in this country because you're just living off everybody else.
And you know, there are many medical reasons for why families don't have children or can't have children, and you know that is so insulting.
I mean, medical reasons, you know.
Personal reasons, family reasons.
Ambivalence. Not liking children, you know, all of those things.
He at one point drew Pete Buttigieg into this conversation.
Yes,
he talked about how gay couples are spawning some sort of dark chaos because they can't have children. And Buttigieg was on some late night show and very effectively, as he always does, put that down by saying, talking about, you know, the chaos that is in his house every day with, you know, two toddlers trying to feed them and diaper them and get them to sleep. And he says that there certainly is chaos, but he wouldn't say it was dark at all.
But think about this, though.
No, and again, he's at least investing in the future.
But Trump, I mean, Trump was able to go silent after the debate debacle. Okay, we really didn't hear anything. And then there was the assassination attempt, and we dealt with the couple days of the Messianic, you know, this was God's will. And then we went into the convention. With Biden running, he didn't have to, all he had to do was to shut his mouth and he was going to glide into reelection. And it's all different now. And the more that Harris and whoever the vice president nominee is going to be keeps Vance and Trump talking, the more this country is going to go, oh my God, I forgot how crazy they really are. And you know, we said on the show, you know, a couple of for a while now, that the worst thing that could happen is if Trump was allowed to hide who he is and what he is, that's changed.
So let's go to a couple letters before we have to go to a break at the bottom of the hour. Desiree says, a woman's very existence is criticized from babyhood. The female identity is criticized from our body, our appearance, our mind, our feelings, even our thoughts. Every aspect of ourselves is scrutinized and questioned. Women must continue to push back in every space and be seen in those spaces until they are normalized. Unfortunately, society and most cultures are like this. It is up to us to show we are not just an appearance. Then we go to Mary. Lawrence O'Donnell, in his program last evening, made the point that heads of the Secret Service going back to 1963 who presided over assassination attempts on Presidents Kennedy, Ford, Reagan, were not asked to resign and did not resign. I wonder why now, not then.
I think it's because the whole tenor of the Hill, I think the whole questioning of public officials, the fact that, you know, even within our own neighborhood, we have a congresswoman who just takes great pride in, you know, in the frankly the character assassination of people who appear before Congress. The whole tenor has changed, and the whole expectation of service has changed. The Washington is nowhere near as clubby as it was in the '60s and in the '80s. And while that may be good in some ways, It certainly is a tough, vile place to be right now.
One more letter, and then we'll take a break. Patty writes, the Trump rally was an epic fail for the Secret Service, but so was Uvalde for local law enforcement, despite shooter drills. As a society, we are woefully unprepared for the culture of the lone, disaffected man with an automatic weapon. As long as we prioritize guns over people, we will never be safe. We'll pause there with Patty's note and invite you to add your note to the pile. All you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We will have another round of the conversation when we return with Judy Patrick, Vera Carius Kelly, Bob Griffin, and Jennifer Burns. First, we have a few messages and then news from the BBC coming up. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday morning, the 24th of July, 10:33. And we welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. Two quick letters, and then we'll move on. We go to Rob, who says, FYI, George Washington had no children. His wife did from her first marriage. It was good enough for George, .. yes. Okay. Let's see. Melinda says, Kamala's husband does have children. She is their stepmom. Mm-hmm. Families come in all sorts of combinations. That is absolutely true. But again, that was not how J.D. Vance sees it, but that was our point.
Right. But yes. You know, she does have a very cute nickname, right? Those two daughters call her Mamala.
Mamala, yeah.
No, those are her nieces, I think, who call her Mamala, right?
Is it?
I think it's her nieces who call her that.
Okay.
Yeah. Because,
but it's a very cute and endearing term, right? Because she's clearly involved in their lives. They like her. I mean, it's nice. And Doug Emhoff also seems super supportive. He seems like a good partner. So,
yeah, I think he has a son and daughter from previous marriage. Yeah.
I don't even get Vance's logic. Does that mean someone who has 10 children is more valuable than someone who has one child?
Well, they put more into the they're invested more into the future.
Maybe they should pay more in school taxes too.
How do you suppose that feels for a military family because he's a military guy, right? How does it feel for a military family who's lost their children in wars to hear him say a comment like that? You know, are they now, I mean, it's a double cruel injury to the loss that they've experienced.
I mean, it just goes into this whole pile of cruel
it's just,
things that are being said from that side. But
and there is a number of articles about the Republican, you know, think tanks going, his Diet Coke comments and Diet Pepsi,
Mountain Dew. I didn't even get that.
Nobody did. It was only in his own mind. No. So, I mean, that's...
I think it was probably a decade and a half ago, there was a major crisis because there was so much soda, but in particular, Mountain Dew in many of the rural communities and vending machines that it was rotting children's teeth. So there was a push to bring in eccentric things that I like.
You speak J.D. Vance. Thank you.
So I knew what he was talking about. I also thought that it was just, mocking in a degrading kind of way. Yeah. And so I thought, again, how you're also out of touch because it was not a source of pride that people in the neighborhood had about their children's teeth, right? Yeah. And that they couldn't get or see a dentist. So,
or you try? It's
and I don't know
appalling.
If that's exactly what he was alluding to, but I do know that was a crisis across the country probably a decade and a half ago.
You know, it's fascinating, though.
That will end on day one.
Real quick is that, I mean, this points to the need for better health care.
Yes.
It's like, which you don't want to do. Right. I mean, the very thing that you're laughing about, again, points to the failure of your policy positions.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's go just one more letter because I think it's worth addressing because we've had many comments like this over the last couple days. I think one vulnerability that Kamala has would be her handling of the responsibility for dealing with the problems at the southern border. How do you see her defending against this, Vera?
Yeah, I mean, this is really, I think, her vulnerability. I agree. She was assigned by President Biden to be the representative to speak with leaders in Guatemala and Mexico and other countries. I don't think in the beginning she did a great job. But in the end, she was on the Biden-Harris ticket. So she did not develop her own policies towards the border. She had to carry out a policy. And I think she needs to refine her position on the border and develop her own approach to how to deal with the southern border, which is why I think she might just pick. I mean, we were sort of playing with the idea, who's she going to pick for vice president? She might need somebody from a southern state for that reason, potentially, to take that on. So it wasn't one of the areas of strength, and she was sort of constrained, I think, by the Biden administration early on that issue. And I think she really needs to work on that profile aspect.
If I could, I would counterpunch immediately with we had a great piece of legislation that was proposed that fundamentally changed the immigration laws, and it was scuttled by Donald J. Trump. I mean, stop apologizing. Yep. Stop being on, come out and be just as forceful and remind people there were fundamental changes that were negotiated between conservative Republicans and Democrats, and Donald Trump scuttled it because it wasn't good for Donald Trump, not because it was good for the country.
He wanted this issue to be a debate issue, and that's why he didn't want an agreement.
Yes.
But in essence, in deep in my heart, I'm very happy that legislation didn't go forward because it was really harsh. Well, I think we need a better discussion about the multi-dimensional issues along the border rather than just a hardcore approach to, like, one solution solves all problems.
I think she can offer that. I think she can approach it or frame it in the under the Trump administration this, Biden had asked me to go as vice president to look into this. I gleaned all of this knowledge. Here are some of the things I think really need to be fixed. And that way she's not saying anything negative about Biden. And then she can go right to what Bob said, that what I informed Biden, he took within his plan in the administration. It went before Congress and the Republicans shot it all down. And I think that's a strong way to go. Plus, she can diversify this, too, because it's not just the southern border. It's also the northern border. And it's just immigration from Middle East and Africa and other global places too, and that those policies need to be addressed.
A lot of people are pushing Hillbilly Elegy to read that book to see it of whether you're pro or con. I started reading The Truths We Hold last night, which is the Kamala Harris memoir, An American Journey. It was written, it was her campaign biography, which generally suck. I mean, they're just all awful. But this one's actually pretty good. And she's she does, I mean, obviously it does not include her time as vice president, and was written for her presidential campaign. But to get an idea of who she is and her upbringing and her thoughts and her time in California, I found it, I mean, I'm only a quarter of the way through, but it's really interesting.
You know, what I heard about that book is that it does a fine job of articulating an overall view of her overall view of public service, and it would be to help people be safe. As a prosecutor, she was helping. She wanted people to feel safe in their streets. And at this point, people were arguing that that could be an overarching message that she could incorporate into her presidential campaign, that she wants to keep America safe from the onslaught of what Trump is proposing to do.
Well, the thing I thought was interesting, the opening chapter is her winning her Senate race and on the same night that Trump won the White House in 2016. And she's sitting there at the hotel getting ready to celebrate while everybody is in the audience looking up at the screen crying. And so her speech became exactly what the speech is now. Like, okay, now it's time to fight. Like we have to do what we have to do. And so that in that context, I don't think it's really changed much. And I thought it was an interesting, if you get a chance.
So I wanted to make a comment on Hillbilly Elegy. It starts out kind of interesting. It describes his early life.
Yes.
And then it turns into him, speaking on behalf of all people in Appalachia because he has all the insights, even though he was then living in Cincinnati and had a different life. And he also begins to blame the people for their own choices. He says it's their fault that they're not lifting themselves up by the bootstraps. I'm thinking if you don't have boots, it's pretty hard to pull yourself up by the bootstraps, because if you don't have health care access, if you don't have programming that helps you out and is a stepping stone. And then he says basically he blames people. He says, well, they have programs. Look at me. But they don't take advantage. So they are themselves to blame for their own misery.
Government programs that help you? Wow.
Well, you know,
they did.
I actually read Hillbilly Elegy years ago. Within, I don't know, 8 months or so of when it had been released. And I had read it because people were recommending to me that it was so great. And so as I read it, I thought, well, this is a common experience, because I have on this show too talked about rural poor white people and what they experience, and then the debate over white privilege. And I've said before that not all people experience white privilege the same way. And so as I was reading Hillbilly Elegy, I felt that it was more a book He wants to blame the system for failing the white community, so it's white grievance, because there are many books written like this by people of color and by women all over the country and have for decades. And people just say whatever, you should work harder.
Yes.
And in his case, he is saying, I worked super hard and the system is what failed me. Mm-hmm. And then sort of like my privilege or my race should have given me some more of advantages. I was forgotten. And he's playing on that forgotten Appalachia sort of idea.
Yes.
The problem is there are many people in the beginning
yes.
from Appalachian areas that he's not one of us.
He
doesn't come
exactly.
from us.
And he...
Is that a form of survivor's guilt?
Absolutely not.
No. It's just a sense of he deserves it.
Entitlement. And that even
and
in those spaces that people say he should be comfortable in as a white man, he's uncomfortable. It's because of his growing up in the neighborhood he grew up in, and people don't understand it. Even white people don't get it. And then they created this system that shouldn't be because it affects him differently. It was hard for me.
Yeah.
And I appreciated the book. I'm not going to say I didn't. But
he
makes claims for a
certain group of people.
I just looked back at all the people who recommended it to me, and I realized they were all white males, every one of them. And I thought that's another interesting...
Yeah. But
I don't think that... I'm sorry, but I don't think that book would have been even, you know, remotely popular had people been thirsting for information as to, I'm sorry, how did we elect Trump? And that book came out at exactly that time and was marketed as this is an explanation of the anger that takes place in these red rural areas.
Mm-hmm.
And then it blew up. Yes.
And then I wanted to point out that J.D. Vance benefited from a DEI-like environment because he was chosen to be lifted up to a place like Yale because he came from a poor socioeconomic background. Mm-hmm. If that isn't part of our HEOP or EOP programs,
it's part of the DEI.
It is part of the DEI
initiatives.
Agenda to lift people with talent out of poverty. So it is independent of race.
Mm-hmm.
So J.D. Vance is Mr. DEI in my book.
Mm-hmm.
We are out of time. My thanks to all. You're great. Be well. We'll be back right after this.